I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
The world is yours until it isn't. This is arguably a lesson that the United States will be learning in the near-term future. Now, I don't say that as some type of edgy anti-American grandstanding. But the question of America's status within the liberal world order, namely as its hyperpower, has come into question in recent years. After blunders in the Middle East and the rise of China, what does that mean geopolitically? What is to become of the American Empire and of its opponents, specifically the anti-war movement? Those are the questions we seek to answer on this edition of Parallax Views, a special roundtable discussion against empire with foreign policy analyst Samira Khan, Media Roots Robbie Martin, and freelance journalist Marlon Ettinger. And with that introduction out of the way, why don't we get right to the special roundtable conversation? It's a Parallax Views roundtable on the anti-war movement in America. We have three different guests with us. First, I'd like to introduce Marlon Ettinger, who has been on the show before. He's covered the Jeffrey Epstein trial. Then we have Robbie Martin of Media Roots, another returning guest. And also, first time on our main show, she's been on our Patreon podcast, foreign policy analyst Samira Khan. Everyone, welcome to the show. I don't know, anyone want to do introductions first? Samira, maybe you can introduce yourself to my audience since they may not have heard the Patreon show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again. I am a foreign policy analyst, like you said. I'm working independently at the moment, but I cover the entire world.
That's normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to, you know, stay up to date on every major issue. But simple and short.
Yeah, and I'm Marlon. I've been on the show before, and I've talked a little bit
about some of the stuff we'll talk about today, how, you know, the anti-war movement has certain priorities that might be wrong, or, you know, interpretations that aren't necessarily correct.
And, yeah, I'm Robbie Martin. People probably know me from being Abby Martin's brother, but I do a lot of work on my own as well. I put out a documentary series about think tanks and the neocons a couple years back called The Very Heavy Agenda, and just trying to get the anti-war movement back on track and back into the right framework has been sort of one of my main priorities this last year. And it's gotten actually quite frustrating at times. And I've, you know, I guess I've even developed a little bit of a hate following over it, because I'm, you know, I'm constantly bashing Tucker Carlson. I'm criticizing Tulsi Gabbard, who these people hoist up as sort of the icons of the current anti-war movement. And I just cannot accept that. To me, that's a very low bar. So that's sort of what I've been trying to focus on recently.
Well, speaking of Tulsi, and also just the other candidates in the Democratic race, I mean, we have Bernie, who I know Samira and Robbie, you've been very critical of. What do you guys think of the Democratic candidates in terms of their stances on foreign policy? How about we start with Samira on this one?
On foreign policy, they're mostly all pretty bad. I think Bernie is slightly better than Tulsi Gabbard, and she's hailed as this sort of anti-war icon, like Robbie said. She's not anti-war. She's barely anti-interventionist. But Bernie is slightly better than her on Palestine. She's pro-Israel to the max. But he hasn't really taken very strong stances against regime change or war. I mean, you know, he was in favor of bombing Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, list goes on, and he's also in favor of drone strikes. So not a big fan of Bernie's foreign policy. And like every time he issues, you know, some sort of criticism of U.S. foreign policy, it's very weak. It's a tepid critique. But in general, I mean, I wish Mike Gravel had been on the stage, but he's not, unfortunately.
Well, Robbie, I know you also have some criticisms of the candidates. Would you sort of concur with Samira on what she has said so far, and then we'll get Marlon's take?
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's something that we all need to remember from the previous round of elections, is that there is a danger to putting, you know, not any hope. I can understand people's desire to have hope in the sort of the Democratic field, but I think there is a danger in putting too much hope into Bernie, as we saw from the last election. It's like he was the one who could have actually stood up to the DNC and said, this was rigged against me, this was an unfair process. I mean, his reaction to just that alone, I think, is very alarming and troubling, and shows and illustrates actually how poorly he would do if he was actually versus Trump. I mean, if he wasn't even willing to take the gloves off against Hillary Clinton and the DNC, I have very, very little hope in him, even just from the perspective of like political strategy. And even just the fact that he's not even differentiating himself from Warren right now, who's been trying to steal his thunder in the most obvious ways possible, is also very alarming. He's already should be differentiating himself and criticizing her. And the fact that he's not, I think, is just a sign that he's not the hope that I think everybody should be hedging on right now. I mean, I really think, as crazy as it sounds, we should be preparing for another 4 years of Trump. And I just don't see any of these Democratic contenders, not only like the decent ones winning, but just even beating him in a, you know, in a general election. It's actually super, super depressing to me. I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I deliberately skipped the last debate because I was just like, fuck it. Like, I don't even really care at this point. When I watched parts of it, I was just like, I'm glad I didn't watch this. It's a total waste of time.
Yeah. Marlon, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I would echo a lot of that. And I would also say that I think with these candidates like Gabbard and Sanders, a lot of the ways that people know about them is
sort of through their branding. And that's obviously true for a lot of politics, but people seem to forget that with specifically those two candidates. You know, Gabbard is the anti-war candidate, or Sanders is the, you know, he's the most left on foreign policy, so naturally we're going to be in agreement with him. And I think it's sort of a failure of the alternative media, among many failures, but they don't actually look at their records on war and intervention. You know, yes, Samira mentioned that, yes, Sanders supported the bombing of Yugoslavia, and not reluctantly, you know, vigorously. And then Gabbard, you know, she has this weird reputation as being so anti-war, but you look at her record, and she's talking about, oh, we have to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. We have to worry about Shia influence in Iraq. We have to, and, you know, she's praising the IDF. And it's not like she tries to hide these positions, but people just accept her branding at face value. And
cherry pick only the good shit.
Exactly. Or the shit that sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, I've been pretty supportive of the Bernie campaign, but I do have an issue when people take this sort of stance that, you know, you can't criticize Bernie. I mean, I have no sacred cows, so it's something that gets on my nerves a little. And I do think his foreign policy stuff is very much up for grabs. Even his time as a senator in Vermont, I know he had some ties to the military-industrial complex. I think it was a company that was making fighter jets. They got some nice contracts during his time in a position of power in Vermont. You know, it was interesting with the debates, because I think we've got to this point, and it's very, very different from the Bush years, when, you know, everyone was talking about the Iraq War. I think we had a very energized anti-war movement in this country at that time. Now it seems no one wants to talk about foreign wars anymore. It's all Medicare and climate change, which I think both of those are important issues, but I think they tie into foreign policy. I just had a war tax resistor, the biggest war tax resistor in the country, actually, Larry Bassett, on earlier today. I was interviewing him, and he pointed out, you know, all this money that goes to wars, I mean, it could be redirected to other things, like a Medicare for All program. And I mean, with climate change, a lot of people forget that militarism has a huge effect on environmental issues. But enough with my sort of take on that. What do you guys think about where the anti-war movement is and the way people have shied away from it?
I would say the anti-war movement is dead in the water, and that's partially because anti-war has sort of become like a badge that people wear. You have all these people, you know, on the right who like to say, oh, well, we're against the wars, we're against this, we're against that. And I think the real problem is people don't take an anti-imperialist position. It's like Gabbard's line, I'm against regime change wars. She's not against, like, there's just wars. It's the same thing as Obama said. Obama said no more stupid wars.
I was just going to say that, I mean, I think that part of what happened is ruling class forces in this country co-opted anti-war energy and redirected it to their own purposes. So, for example, the co-opted Koch brothers version of the Tea Party movement. And let's not forget that the Tea Party actually started as a quasi-truther, 9/11 truther and Ron Paul movement, before it was actually co-opted by the mainstream Republican establishment. I think most people don't realize that. What happened at that point was, I think there were actually ruling class factions in this country that realized that the sentiment of anti-war would continue to grow in this country, like legitimate morally, you know, coming from a moral framework, being opposed to intervening in other people's countries where we don't have any business belonging. And what the post-Tea Party sort of anti-war sentiment turned into was, why are we wasting all these resources to help foreigners, basically, when we need to help ourselves? And I think that was a big way where sort of Ron and Rand Paul diverged, is Rand Paul decided to sort of latch himself to that Koch brothers, Ted Cruz, fake co-opted libertarian anti-war side, while Ron Paul sort of stayed in the classic paleo-conservative mold, where, in a lot of ways, as conservative as Ron Paul is, his rhetoric actually sounds more leftist anti-imperialist than Tulsi Gabbard does on foreign policy. And I think that's actually very notable and important as well, that a hardcore conservative like Ron Paul is actually coming from a more of a moral framework on war. If you notice, he doesn't only talk about how this is a waste of resources, why are we trying to get these, you know, people to live in a different way, we need to spend money here. He actually often talks about sort of the moral implications of war, and I think that that's what gets lost in all this. So for people to say that Trump is anti-war, or that people who speak like him are anti-war, I think is a false premise. They're anti this idea that why are we trying to help or rebuild or, you know, lift people up in other countries. They're opposed to this idea of, you know, this quasi fake humanitarian sort of war. And if you even watch like Tucker Carlson's program, even some of his best anti-interventionist rants, they don't have a moral basis to them. I mean, and that's something that's very strange to me, that's so basic, it's so human, you know, it's such an easy thing to sort of put yourself in the position of, oh yeah, I wouldn't want someone from another country to come and bomb me because they didn't like the policies of my government. I mean, so it's, I just find that strange how much that's been missing and how much this sort of, you know, we don't want to waste our resources over their mentality has dominated that anti-war dialogue now, to the point where it seems like almost everybody is talking about it from that framework now. And there's such a little tiny slice left of like actual anti-imperialism that sort of cuts through all that. And it's, yeah, it's depressing. I mean, I don't think we've ever been, we've really fallen quite far from the amount of energy that was there at the tail end of the Iraq war, like the tail end of the Bush administration. And I don't know how we get it back. I mean, that's a question I ponder every day.
Marlon, do you want to chime in? And then, Samira, we can sort of get your take on where the anti-war movement is at right now.
Sure.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of that. It's anti-war, not anti-empire. It's like a badge, you know? And it's never – I think the moral argument's really important. It's never, oh, we're doing – we're committing these crimes against people. We're killing people. It's, well, we're wasting our time. We're wasting our money. It reminds me, you know – there was in the 19th century, there was this American Anti-Imperialist League, and they were really against the war in the Philippines. But their big argument against it was, well, if we conquer the Philippines, we're going to have to take care of all these Philippines people, and then you're going to have Filipinos coming into our country. And do you really want that? And it was came completely out of, you know, racial chauvinism. And there's some of that same thing in the current adoption of anti-war, because anti-war seems really popular. You know, everyone, it seems a popular thing, kind of. Everyone will say they're anti-war. Tucker Carlson says he's anti-war. But it's for these craven, you know, these reasons that don't come from a good place. And in fact, you know, I mean, you can put aside the fact that it's not even true on the face of it. He's for plenty of wars. He's just not for these, like Obama would say, no more stupid wars, right?
Yeah,
which is the exact same line that Gabbard uses, no more regime change wars. Any other wars are fine, of course, just no regime change wars.
And in a way, I think that's a similar framing than what Trump is coming from. People like, you know, Trump himself likes to make him seem like he's a complete polar opposite of Obama. But in a lot of ways, I feel like Trump was influenced by that Obama mentality, the Ben Rhodes, don't do stupid shit mentality. That there is sort of this, you know, in their minds, I think that he's coming from a similar point of view. And it's interesting to me that people try to separate the two of them and make them seem like they're so vastly different. But the same obligations, you know, that people accused Obama of pulling out of towards the end of his term are the same obligations that people were criticizing Trump for that he pulled out of and accused him of being a Russian Manchurian candidate for. So it's interesting the way that that's playing out.
Samira, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I agree with everything Robbie and Marlon are saying, but plain and simple, the anti-war movement of the late 2000s has basically devolved into anti-interventionism at best. Look at who we revere as quote-unquote anti-war heroes, you know, Tucker Carlson and Tulsi Gabbard.
Not to interrupt you, but I just wanted to add, it's almost like the sort of paleo-conservative Lou Rockwell or Ron Paul mentality has sort of won out. And actually, I don't like that isolationist mentality. I mean, I'm an internationalist, but I'm not in favor of, like, the Obama-type globalization or the neocon, you know, war hawk sort of mentality. So I think it's important to differentiate that we need a movement that is left-wing internationalist and against the empire.
Right. And I think it's partially because most people can't differentiate between anti-imperialism and right-wing anti-interventionism. Marlon mentioned the Philippines and, you know, the right-wing anti-interventionist movement that came about during that time. Stephen Kinzer wrote a book about this, basically trying to explain the differences between left-wing anti-imperialism and right-wing anti-interventionism in the 1900s. But yeah, that's basically my point. Look, if you're anti-regime change and, you know, anti some wars, it doesn't really touch the broader strategy of containing China and Russia, right? So it's in the ruling class's favor, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I think just isolating it to this idea of anti-regime change, it's sort of, you know, I was actually debating with Michael Tracy about this point, and he brought up this argument that, well, the reason why, you know, Tulsi Gabbard isn't going against the war on terror is because that's not the paradigm now. What the paradigm now is that it's popular to be, you know, to talk about regime change. Like, that's sort of old news talk about the war on terror. But I would argue actually the opposite, that the war on terror is the current paradigm. It's just become normalized.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
That's why it's not talked about. Actually, in terms of classic regime change like we did in Iraq and Libya, that's not actively happening in that exact same way right now. At least it hasn't been achieved. I mean, they've tried to do it a little bit in Venezuela. They're trying to do it with Iran right now, but not at that same level, not like a full-scale bombing campaign or a ground invasion. So I'm not saying that regime change is an old paradigm, but you could argue that the war on terror is the current paradigm. That is the most where we are actually actively engaged in the world. And technically speaking, that's also the case. I mean, I read off to Michael where our actual military engagements are. Most of the actual active engagements, bombings, troop deployments, missions are all in countries that are part of the war on terror. Somalia, Niger, Yemen. I mean, all these are not, you know, quote unquote regime change operations. Unless you want to make the argument, which I will do, that war on terror is in some way designed to be able to do hegemonic regime change globally. You know, not necessarily every country we bomb for the war on terror will get regime change, but it sort of helps us encroach more around the world in a general sense. So it is a form of, you know, you could argue it's sort of setting up the chess pieces for more regime change. I mean, that's obviously what it's trying to do.
To add to that really quick regarding Michael Tracy's comments, Tulsi Gabbard, she's anti-regime change. And she says this plainly. She says, I'm anti-regime change because it diverts focus from the real mission of eliminating Islamic extremism. And this is shared by people like Marine Le Pen and Richard Spencer. That exact reasoning. So that's, you know, a quick comment I wanted to add.
Yeah, I think I do think that there is some truth to the idea that she is influenced by some hardcore right-wing views. And I think that people on the left or anti-war people who try to brush that under the rug and say it's all smears are being disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I mean, explain why she's sitting there getting an award from Rabbi Shmuley. Is that left-wing? Is it left-wing to attack Obama from the right and say that he's not using the phrase radical Islamic terrorism? I mean, that's right-wing rhetoric.
And on top of that, you know, she's so against arms sales to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, but she's completely in favor of arms sales to India, Israel, and Ukraine. What does that say?
It says she's taking a position that has no principle. And it's funny you bring that up, because I just read there was a big long piece in the Caravan the other day about her relationship to the Sang, which is, probably pronouncing it wrong, but the RSS, which is the BJP, which is the ruling party in India, in America. And it's completely, I mean, I would say damning if anyone reads it. She is completely, she tried to get Modi, his visa, unrevoked after Modi led, gave assent for massacres in Gujarat. And, she got like donations, like right after she spoke in Congress with them, tons of donations. So she was completely pushing them.
And she fundraised for the BJP prior to Modi winning and prior to her election, actually. And she's appeared at events for these groups. And if you look at her foreign policy, clearly, I mean, everything is aligned with Hindutva. You know, the whole focus on Islamic extremism, calling for an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, but not Israel.
You know, there was just a an Indian celebrity that came out and said, in regards to Kashmir, he said something along the lines of, and I'm blanking on his name, but he said, the Kashmir solution is coming.
And and then people related it to, the final solution. I remember that.
Well, it's just bizarre, because when you bring these things up to the Tulsi supporters, at this point, it's like a cult. Where if you can't question Tulsi at all, and I just find that, like I said, I don't like sacred cows, and to me it's just bizarre that this one candidate apparently is not up for criticism at all, despite her record. As Marlon has pointed out, her record is not that great. I don't understand it, and it's interesting, Samira, because we had you on the Patreon feed, and I've interviewed multiple guests about Tulsi. I've interviewed Albert Lanier, who's actually a journalist in Hawaii, so he knows a lot about her record in Hawaii. And I interviewed Marlon about Tulsi. But it was funny, because when I interviewed you, people got very, very angry. I still get mail about that. I still get emails, texts, direct messages about the interview we did on Patreon. I think there's a lot going on there. I feel like there's a lot of and listeners will get mad that I'm saying this, but
well, yeah, most of them they hate the fact that I'm Muslim, and they think that Muslims are inherently incapable of being objective on Hindutva, Tulsi Gabbard, etc. So they get really, really upset. And I've been very hard on her, because I come from the region, so I know how much of a threat Hindutva is. And, when they ask you to, condemn Pakistan or, condemn all of the violence that Islam has supposedly perpetrated, that's inherently Islamophobic, right? Because they're not going to ask Peter Frederick, who wrote that Caravan article that was mentioned, to condemn Pakistan and condemn Islamic extremism, quote unquote. They're going to ask me to do that because my last name is Khan and I'm a Muslim. So, because I remember the last time, they got really, really angry, like you said. And it's just, it's become like a cult. I mean, the FBI came to investigate me for Islamic extremism after this. Really? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to talk about it too much, but in my conversation with these FBI agents, it was very, very clear that it was related to Hindutva.
Well, I was going to say I was going to say the other thing I noticed that is going on is, I got really mad when I think, Samira, we were, I mentioned you on Twitter once, when talking about Tulsi, and not only did they scream, Hindu phobia, but they started bringing up that you were, in the Miss New Jersey pageant, and they were belittling you, over that. And I'm like, she has a degree in international relations. I mean, just because someone did a beauty pageant doesn't disqualify them. There's so much sexism to it.
Yeah, I did it as a hobby, right? I did it as a hobby, and I mean, like my whole career in journalism and analysis and at RT's just, you know, wiped away because of that one pageant I did. It's ridiculous.
I think it also, I think this touches on a broader point about the anti-war movement. And I think maybe Robbie would be able to talk about it. He talked, you know, with the war on terror rhetoric. And it's this idea that Islam is the most potent threat in the world and it has to be opposed. And I mean, that's a mainstream opinion, you know, mm-hmm. And as if it's the most, as if, you know, the U.S. Army is not the most potent threat in the world. I mean, who's killed more in the past 10 years, right?
Right.
Or, and it really is a problem because it's accepted at face value. You know, a lot of people, so-called anti-war, will say, oh, well, that's true. You know, they did attack us on 9/11, right, Robbie? So.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen this strange convergence over the last few years between the left, even anti-imperialists on the left, and right-wingers who will you know, sort of converge on this issue that the biggest threat is Wahhabism, or one of the, you know, Wahhabism is a real threat, and Saudi Arabia, you know, is exporting all this Wahhabism, and, you know, Wahhabists and Salafist Muslims are, you know, dangerous people, they'll say, and that they are a threat. And this is sort of a narrative that I even see, like, you know, even anti-imperialists that I generally have respect for sort of putting out. Maybe they don't talk about it being as threatening as the right does, but they do talk about it like it is a really serious problem that is the source of most of, like, the world's terrorism. And I think that that is playing into, to a certain degree, basically like a Sam Harris paradigm. To say that, you know, like, let's just isolate to Saudi Arabia. I mean, if all these people being indoctrinated by, like, you know, Saudi Arabian public schools or these madrasas, as people, you know, like to refer to them as being like extremist schools, why is it that, you know, Saudi Arabians in general are not all going off and doing terrorism? I mean, it's, you know, then you get into this premise that, oh, it's just being sort of exported to these other poorer nations, you know, to sort of manipulate them into becoming their foot soldiers. But I think that that's sort of a problematic slippery slope in and of itself, because it's even saying that certain sects, you know, even just if we're isolated to Wahhabism, I think there's an argument to be made that most people who even espouse that rhetoric are not terrorists. They're not committing terrorism. So that's like... So to even just, and I think it plays on people's ignorance. It's a newer iteration of saying that Islam is a violent religion. So it's a newer iteration designed to sort of fool people on the left. That's sort of what I believe. And I also think it also becomes problematic with Syria when so much of the focus again goes to not this fact that we're waging a proxy there by funding rebel groups, but that it's all because of these jihadis in Syria that are being funded by us, but not the overall CIA rebel program. And I find that a strange framing too, because it's like, well, what does that mean? So are you not criticizing the non-jihadist aspect of the CIA rebel program? Because you never talk about that. And why has that sort of vanished from the anti-imperialist left side of the debate? Like, I've read books on Syria recently that barely even talk about the construction of how the CIA rebel program worked. All they want to talk about is how every white helmet's an Al-Qaeda. And I just find that kind of, honestly, a weird small zone to really focus on constantly. And I think it really does leave a lot of other areas open that we need to sort of jump on and start talking about.
And they don't even mention the fact that this Salafi Wahhabi extremism that's supposedly the greatest threat to world peace was funded and, you know, basically brought about in the Middle East to contain Nasserism. They don't mention that aspect of it, which is in itself problematic. In regards to Syria, yeah, I totally agree with you. But right now, even that, you know, the war is nearly over. So I wonder, you know, where they're going to move next, right? Because Syria is looked upon as, you know, the where this Salafi Wahhabi extremism is coming into force. But let's see what happens next. I wonder what country it's going to be.
Yeah, I feel like it's not over in Syria. I feel like there's still going to be a U.S. push of some kind. I don't know how it's gonna happen.
Yeah, that's true as well.
Maybe the whole combating Iranian influence, that angle, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
The Shia militias, because every Shia pledges loyalty to Iran at the beginning of the day, right? Yeah. I mean, if you listen to these people, you'd believe that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wanted to get on the subject of Iran. You know, it's been an interesting week or so. I mean, we had John Bolton getting kicked out of the Trump administration, and people were celebrating that. Although, to me, I'm like, Bolton, what's that?
That was just this week?
I think that was a week or two ago.
Anyway, excuse me. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say I'm not sure the celebration means much because he's still gonna have a job with some kind of think tank. Probably he probably does right now, and also we could end up just getting someone worse. And it seems like Trump wants to escalate conflict with Iran, and you know, especially now in light of the Houthi rebels attacking the Saudi oil facility. I wanted to get your take on that, Samira. Where do you think this is going with Iran and the recent developments?
I don't think it's solely a Trump thing, because they've been pondering, you know, invasion of Iran since 1979, and even in after 2001, when it was named on the Axis of Evil. But you look at Iran right now, canceling the Iran deal was the start of it. But I actually am not too sure that Hillary would have stuck to the Iran deal either, because if you look at what she had said in 2008 against Obama, Obama was willing to talk to Iran. She said flat out, I'm not going to talk to Iran. She called them terrorists. And then she also said, if I am president, we will attack Iran. So I'm not sure that Hillary would have stuck with the Iran deal. The thing is, like, you know, it's really difficult to say what's going to happen now, but they're going for Iran's ballistic missiles. I think what Trump wanted to do, even Tulsi Gabbard, they both wanted to put either sanctions or, you know, restrict Iran's ballistic missile capabilities, which, you know, is completely allowed under international law. It's a major component of a country's national defense. And then to put restrictions on that or to sanction them, it's like stripping a country of its defense capabilities. So, and then you look at what, you know, will happen after that, you know, obviously it leads to regime change or proxy war. Who knows?
Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking about, Samira, recently is that I could see Saudi Arabia and Iran getting into a direct war with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, what they're describing now, they're trying to frame it like it already is a proxy war between the two of them. I mean, I don't know if you saw this recent news from, I think it was like 3 days ago, it's not that recent, but the U.S. government is now leaking to all these news outlets who are now, you know, of course, just echoing it like it's fact, that these drone attacks on the Saudi oil fields were done from an Iranian military base. That's the rhetoric that they're putting out. And that's crazy inflammatory. I mean, that's basically a huge escalation, you know, that they're trying to say happen, that this is a direct military attack on Saudi Arabia from Iran. And what I'm afraid of that could happen here, this is one of the possible scary potentials here, is that Saudi Arabia and Iran could get into a conflict, and then the U.S. could join in that way.
Israel,
and then, you know, then we get Russia. Then maybe even China. And basically, I think at that point, it's safe to call it World War III. I think Syria, the fact that we didn't get into a full-blown World War III during that was kind of a miracle, if you really think about what was going on. So I just cannot see even a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran going off without it escalating into a potentially close to World War III-like scenario. I don't want to be too fear-mongery and say that it's going to be, you know, nukes dropping. I just mean that, you know, we've been on the verge of this multiple times just since the Obama administration. So, I mean, this is not a laughing matter. Like, Ukraine alone could have been a potential World War III escalation. So, Yeah, we gotta take this shit seriously.
Well, I think it's an interesting point because I think the pushback we'll get is, you know, people always like to bring up to me, oh, well, Seymour Hersh has been saying for, you know, 20 years now that we're going to go to war with Iran. It'll never happen. And I'm just not sure how to respond to people that think that. I mean, I think there's been a push for it. It just it doesn't have enough support from the public.
Yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing here is, like, why are we – that's, to me, is kind of like hopeful, overly hopeful, optimistic point of view that the people in charge aren't crazy enough to do it. Like, ultimately, on some level, they don't necessarily care about the consequences. They clearly have these very strong views that they have the right to take out these regimes and countries and basically take ownership of them. So to think that they're going to be like, oh, shucks, we got cold feet. The American public isn't going to go for it again this time, guys. Well, look, all that has to happen is another 9/11 style event for everybody to be shocked again into total complacency and acquiescence for anything they want to do.
Yep.
It's the sad reality. You know, if we think people are going to not be jolted into just being total slaves again after another terrorist attack, I think we'd be really naive to think that.
Well, I think it's interesting to, you know, one elephant in the room for me in all of this, and we didn't get to mention it earlier, was, you know, we were talking about how the anti-war movement has sort of gone in a what we would consider a downhill direction. And I think part of it, and Robbie, I think you can comment on this because of a very heavy agenda. I think a lot of people have not properly held the neocons' feet to the fire, so to speak, because after years of propaganda against Muslims, against Islam as a religion, by people in very high positions of power. I mean, I was just talking to some people about Michael Schur at CIA. He was the head of the Bin Laden unit. I mean, he wants to blow up the entire Middle East. And he's a big Trump supporter now. But you have people like that. You had people like John Bolton. You had the Bush administration. And, you know, I think we have an entire generation of young people, especially Gen Z and a lot of millennials, that they were brought up to hate Islam. And I think that's a large legacy of the neoconservatives that people don't talk about. And I think it's going to have really bad ramifications. I think we're seeing it right now.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they basically, they knew what they were doing. I mean, it's bad enough when, you know, a group, a racist or racial separatist group puts out inflammatory racist rhetoric to gin up the public and rile people up and upset them. And generate hate. That's bad enough. But the neocons are smart enough where they, you know, even if they had inherent racism towards Arabs, they were very specifically trying to put out rhetoric to really catch the attention of, like, middle America and regular folks around the country. They lit a match in a gasoline-soaked room, and now they're just acting like, whoops, like, I don't know how this caught on fire. I don't know how Trump, a crazy guy, you know, got elected, who's saying he wants to kill terrorists and their families and bring back waterboarding. I don't know how that happened.
It's their Frankenstein's monster. It's exactly. Their Frankenstein monster. The Tea Party, Trump, all of it. It's theirs.
And Robert Kagan, this is the fucking balls this guy has. He wrote an article saying that Trump is the Republican Party's Frankenstein monster without blaming the neocons at all. And it's just like, dude, you know exactly how much of a role you played in this. Fucking snake.
Well, hey, Marlon, you've been a little bit quiet on your end. I want to get your take on maybe the legacy of the neocons and where things are headed in regards to rising Islamophobia in this country.
I would say legacy is almost the wrong word because they haven't gone away. I always say that Trump is just Bush 2.0. You look at his entire administration and bureaucracy, it's all staffed by figures who are in the first two Bush administrations. And, you know, despite Trump saying he rejecting Bush and making fun of Jeb, you know, nothing has changed in D.C. in that respect, really, the whole orientation. And then as for Islamophobia, I think it just goes to a little bit more of an abstract point, which is part of their propaganda that, you know, it's this idea that religious violence or religiously motivated violence is uniquely bad. Our violence is
you know, we think about our violence, but their violence is fanatical and they don't even think about it. That's why they're so dangerous, which is, you know, really racist assumption, but that's what they say, you know. You know, even though Bush said we're on a crusade, that's not religious violence. We've thought about our violence. We're civilized. It's the whole clash of civilizations thing. And they used and they continue to use Muslims and Arabs because, I guess, I don't know why. Well, I mean, because that's where they wanted to advance their interests. Those were the people they were going to have to kill.
I mean, now it's even extended beyond, you know, this war on terror. I mean, you know, at the Democratic debates, we had Bernie going off on Venezuela. We have that horrible new Tom Clancy TV series on Amazon. I think it's called Jack Ryan, where in the trailer they actually say, you know, if there's a nuclear-armed Venezuela helped by China, you won't live to see it because the nukes will have already gone off. And I'm like, I'm just thinking to myself, you know, America is just willing to go against the entire world. I mean, even with China, I mean, I think Steve Bannon and a lot of liberals have a lot in common with their sort of, you know, saber rattling towards China. And I think we're seeing it all across the political spectrum. Russia, the Middle East, it's just bizarre.
It is. And one would expect, you know, these commentators who talk about Russophobia all the time to say something about Sinophobia, but they don't, which it's very frustrating to me because I can't really explain that unless it's actually motivated by racism.
Well, I mean, some of it probably is because a lot of the, you know, a lot of these conservatives have just suddenly turned sort of more pro-Russia over time.
Right.
And those same people are extremely, you know, racist towards the Chinese. I mean, they, you know, you hear even Alex Jones, who used to talk about how the American system in Silicon Valley was like the new panopticon that we should be worried about. Now talking all about how China is the surveillance state we should be worried about because now they control Google. You know, this is the sort of right-wing narrative that they're putting out. And you're totally right. There is this weird shift that seems very deliberately sort of, you know, pushing more, it's sort of moving the needle towards China and not so much towards Russia. And then, of course, we see these Hong Kong protests being broadcast all over the news when I dare you to show me a single video of those protests that looks as brutal as anything that we saw, like the guy's eyeball getting blasted out in the Yellow Vest protest in France, or Scott Olsen's head, his skull being caved in with a tear gas grenade in the Occupy Oakland protests. So don't show me pictures of the Hong Kong protests. Try to get me outraged about them as if we should, you know, do regime change there.
Yeah, and another one is the Uyghur population in Western China and, you know, the concentration camps. It's also, it must be a coincidence that the same organization, the NED, that funds the Hong Kong protesters, they also fund Uyghur separatist groups. So it's playing out everywhere. And specifically with the Uyghurs, I'm not pronouncing this correctly, Xinjiang is the hub of One Belt, One Road. So if Xinjiang it becomes East Turkestan and it's established as an independent sovereign state, then there goes One Belt, One Road.
And well, this sudden concern, you know, by for, you know, just like we were talking about before, so the sudden concern for Muslims is obviously not coming out of principle, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, I've been writing about this as well. Sorry, go ahead.
That was it. Yeah, you know, whatever, it's like Robbie pointed out the hypocrisy. Well, whatever you think of what's going on, it's not like these concerns are rooted in principle. You know, they're being promoted to advance, like you mentioned, very certain geopolitical goals.
Well, I was going to say in relation to the Hong Kong protests, I've been generally supportive of it, but at the same time, I'm very nervous about some of these protesters, because a lot of them, I'm pretty sure from the research I've done and the people I've talked to, like Carl Zhe of the Silk and Steel podcast, they're strong nativist and right-wing elements in those protests that I think people should be concerned about.
Yeah, and not just that. I mean, the sort of the relationship between a lot of these strange multimillionaire media moguls, some of them in their early 20s, who are in Hong Kong, who own like several TV stations and newspapers, having regular meetings with John Bolton and Bannon. I mean,
and the white helmets.
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff is very questionable, and I'm not saying that means it's all fake or it's all AstroTurf. It just means that whenever there's an opportunity, I mean, this could have started organically, but if you look into how it started, apparently this time these protests started over the trial of a murder of a pregnant woman, where they tried to extradite him back to China, trying to get him, and the Hong Kong government wouldn't let him or something. I'm probably getting the details wrong. Maybe someone else could fill those in, but... it's not what you think it is. Let's just put it that way.
What do you guys think of, speaking of things not being as they seem, I'm curious to what you guys think about the new institute. It's an anti-war think tank, the Quincy Institute, which, oddly enough, is being funded by George Soros and the Koch brothers. I believe Charles Koch was funding it. David, of course, recently passed. But it's interesting. I don't hear a lot of people in the anti-war movement or the anti-imperialist movement even talking about that institute and maybe how we should be on guard about it.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably because, well, I haven't talked about it much because I'm waiting to see what's going to happen with it. And I have respect for and like the people involved. Two guys that I know are involved, Stephen Wertheim and Eli Clifton, have both done some really good work on neocons. They're definitely not as like far left as I am, or anti-imperialist as I am, or you guys are. But at the same time, I mean, the name in and of itself is kind of troubling. Let's not even talk about the funding for a second. But John Quincy Adams, that's who the institute is named after, John Adams' son. Actually was the one who Robert Kagan quoted in my film as saying that America is destined by the finger of God. So like John Quincy Adams, maybe he had some like anti-war statements at some point in his lifetime, but he also said some crazy shit that's extremely like imperialist and actually really cutting edge imperialism for the time period. You know, he was also the guy who actually, anybody out there seen the movie Amistad by Steven Spielberg. That's about John Quincy Adams being a lawyer after his retirement from politics, defending a slave who murdered some of his captors on a slave ship on its way to the United States. So, I mean, he's definitely an interesting character, but I'm a little skeptical of just even naming it after him in the first place, personally.
Marlon, do you have anything to add to that?
I haven't heard about the Quincy Institute, so no.
And neither have I. So,
well, check out Eli Clifton's work. The guy that I know who's associated with it, he's one of the best guys out there who's tracking the activities of an obscure think tank in D.C. called the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And that actually has a lot of other neocons who come from PNAC in that think tank. And some people from that think tank have gone into the Trump administration. So his work is important to check out. But I can't vouch for the think tank itself. And the funding, suspicious. I don't buy that George Soros and the Koch brothers want to end war. I don't buy it. And it's kind of makes me go weird in my head about Tulsi Gabbard. I'm kind of thinking, well, Koch brothers and Soros are funding this. Who is actually Tulsi Gabbard? Who's she working for? But that's all I'll say on that, because that already probably sounds a little too paranoid.
Yeah.
I mean, Samira, have you looked at any of that with regards to Tulsi's funding or?
I have not, but she is funded by different defense or corporations. I haven't gone too deeply into that, but I do have her record like memorized by heart, so you can ask me about individual positions on foreign policy. But
I would say just before that to the funding, you know. The article talks about 25% of her funding came from American sang organizations about that
right.
Each election cycle. So there is that, but go ahead with the foreign policy.
Yeah, and if you look at what Marlon just mentioned, the American Sangh, they also, the BJP and the RSS, they're also against regime change. They condemned regime change in Syria. They condemned regime change in Venezuela, etc. So, again, aligned with RSS policy. And also, this isn't mentioned, but India and the U.S. are aligned right now because they both have mutual interests in containing China. And India claims Tibet and Aksai Chin, which is part of Kashmir. It's Chinese Kashmir. So India claims that as well. So it's in their interest to contain China. And also India and Israel have multiple military pacts and agreements.
Well, Samira, something I wanted to ask you about. I know you were, I think you did a report recently, a little video report on Bernie Sanders' comments on Kashmir, and it was largely positive. But one thing you pointed out is that a lot of Americans are not very supportive of Pakistan. And it's interesting to me because I think India, Pakistan, and China are all going to play a big role in the future. And I think right. It would be good to foster positive relations with Pakistan. Maybe you could comment on that, if relations between U.S. and Pakistan can get better, and also the role those three countries will play in the future of geopolitics.
Yeah, well, I don't think the U.S. and Pakistan are going to be friends anytime soon, because Pakistan is China's number one ally. And it's, I think, the only country in the region that's actually pro-China. So the reason why One Belt, One Road hasn't been killed by the U.S. and India in the subcontinent is because of Pakistan's participation. Now, One Belt, One Road also runs through Pakistani Kashmir. So India, right now, they've declared Pakistani Kashmir and Chinese Kashmir as part of India with the intention of killing One Belt, One Road. They've even formally requested China to stop One Belt, One Road in what they see as their territory. And China has basically condemned India's move as a violation of the territorial sovereignty of Pakistan as well. So right now we're seeing Pakistan and China on one side. And because this heightens tensions with India and China, I feel like it's looked upon positively in the U.S. as well, as part of their broader strategy to contain China. But nobody, if you look at Western media reports, if you look at even, you know, foreign media reports, whether it's RT or Telesur, nobody talks about China's involvement in Kashmir. And this is three nuclear powers, and one nuclear power has violated the territorial sovereignty of two other nuclear states. So it's, I mean, it could be a total mess. Let's just put it that way.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think looking at China, Pakistan, and India, one thing I think America is very nervous about is, and I'm going to be accused of being like some Alexander Dugin type person for saying this, but I think America has to realize that it's not the only country in the world, and we have to work with other countries. We have to have diplomatic relations. We can't just strong arm people. I don't think that's really necessarily a Duganist take on it, but
well, America is reluctant to embrace, you know, the new multipolar world. You know, want to maintain dominance. So that's all I have to say.
Well, Robbie, maybe you could comment on that, because I feel like talking about the multipolar world, I don't feel that that's necessarily just something that the right has like a stranglehold on. Like I said, people will say, as soon as you mention multipolar world, I've had people say Dugin, and I'm like, no. I mean, he may be right about that, but I really don't like Alexander Dugin. I think he's a fascist. But, you know, the issue of we're going back to a sort of multipolar world where there will be multiple superpowers. What do you think about that, Robbie?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's like, so what is their argument against that point of view that we should have, that America should be the dominant superpower, everything it can to maintain its hegemony? I mean,
there's people on the left that would say anyone who is against interventionism in Syria is part of a fascist cabal. I mean, there's a whole conspiracy theory on the left about that. So, yeah, there are people like that. It's kind of odd to me.
Yeah, I mean, we need to, you know, you don't have to put it into the framing of using the language of a multipolar world to just describe the general concept of relinquishing America's role, you know, at the very least, of being the world's police and just trying to increase its reach. So by the very nature of pulling back on American empire, we would organically, just as a result, have a more multipolar world. You know, so you don't have to use that phrase, but I mean, yeah, I mean, for people who want to say that that's Duganist or whatever, that's it's fucking ridiculous. It's just not allowing the American empire to do everything terrible under the sun to maintain its stranglehold over this empire. And it's in a lot of ways, it is a failing empire. And, you know, I think the 9/11 attacks bought it a lot of time. And that time is sort of, you know, it's dwindling. I think the American empire is in decline. And I think we are going to see things shift into a multipolar direction, whether these neocons are, you know, crazy nationalists in D.C. like it or not. And they're having a hard time adjusting to that. But I think we can't also relax into that mindset either. I think they're desperate enough to do anything that they can to get things to return back to the framework that America does need to be the dominant superpower in the world. And to get
people, even if
there's
a body count.
Exactly. To get people to believe that again is the important part. It needs to be like a religion, like it was in the 80s during the Cold War, like it was the beginning of the War on Terror. So,
Marlon, do you want to comment on that maybe?
Yeah, I think, though, I mean, it's out of the U.S.'s control in a sense, and their period after the Second World War of almost complete dominance, and then their false, you know, hope after the Soviet Union, had to dissolve, is gone. They thought there was going to be unparalleled dominance, and they have. The U.S. has enjoyed unparalleled dominance for the longest period of time in modern history, and I think, yeah, the process of that ending will be violent. There's no way around it, you know.
Well, it's interesting to me too, because I mean, even looking at this situation with Iran and Saudi Arabia, I mean, let's just even if it was as simple as the Iranians supporting the Houthi rebels financially, if Iran supported Iraqi rebels, I've said to people, and this will get people very angry when I say it, what is Iran supposed to do? Are they supposed to sit back and just wait for the U.S. to come for them next? Because that's what the plan seems to be. I don't understand. It's almost like the U.S. expects every country to just roll over like a dog. Roll over and we're going to kick you. That's sort of the mentality.
Well, that's the public framing. That's like the PR framing. I think in reality, they're hedging on the fact that some of these countries are actually going to do something, like in the same way that in the Old West, the sheriff throws the gun on the ground and tells the guy, pick up the gun. I mean, I really do think in a large way that is how the American foreign policy establishment strategically thinks about these things. They're trying to egg Iran into a fight. And in some ways, it's actually worked. You know, I don't know how many of these, you know, oil tanker things were real. You know, it seems largely unproven. Even the Japanese owner of one of those oil tankers said it wasn't even a mine that hit it, that they were trying to say was like the Revolutionary Guard that put a mine on this tanker. But the Iranian government did seize, I believe, a British oil tanker fairly recently and held their crew for a few days. And that's like a pretty ballsy thing for them to do. And they're definitely being, you know, they're definitely trying to assert themselves, let's just say, in that way. So I think that that's what the U.S. wants them to do. It's almost the same thing when Maduro said right after that humanitarian convoy stunt happened, he said all U.S. diplomats must leave the country within 24 hours. And the Trump administration returned with, no, all U.S. diplomats stay in the country. So Maduro made the decision not to go and arrest those diplomats. He backed down because that's how the U.S. works. They want Maduro to go and arrest those diplomats because that will be an outrageous international incident that CNN and Fox and MSNBC could pump on the news 24/7 for, you know, 2 weeks straight. So I think that that's largely how the psychology of this works.
I have a question for you, Robbie. Earlier you mentioned that, you know, a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran would turn into this World War III like situation with Russia and China involved. But do you really think Russia and China would get involved militarily?
I think if the U.S. I don't know if it'll be. It won't be, like a direct military thing. I think it could be some kind of mission creep similar to Syria, where it could start with bombings, just drone attacks or jets and different parties, you know, bombing different territories. I don't think it's going to – I don't think Russia and China are dumb enough to, get involved with troops or anything like that. I haven't lived long enough to see a full-scale world war. So I do think, in our generation or my generation, it's hard to actually picture something like that happening right now. But I think anything's on the table. I mean, I think the U.S. is the questionable element here, where the U.S. is fucking crazy. And that's the thing that we have to worry about. It's not China and Russia that we have to worry about, you know, intervening and doing something too brazen or irresponsible. It's the U.S.
Yeah,
trying
of course.
To do something nuts and then sucking the whole, you know, world system down with it. I mean, like Marlon said, I think if the U.S. empire really does go into serious decline, it's not going to end without some kind of violent spasm of some kind. So.
Well, there's just one more thing I wanted to cover. We've sort of mentioned it in passing. Is Saudi Arabia and Samira? This may interest you. I'm looking over reports right now. Tulsi has said she got real angry at Trump and she was wagging her finger, calling him a servant of Saudi Arabia. I'm very critical of Saudi Arabia. I've had guests on to talk about the Saudi Arabia 9/11 connection and whatnot, but it's interesting. I see this turn against Saudi Arabia now within the public discourse, and I'm just like, you know, a lot of us were talking about this 10-15 years ago, and now all of a sudden it's popular. What do you make of the situation with Saudi Arabia and the sort of turn we're seeing with it?
Well, I hate this because even in the early 2000s, I don't think the U.S. was, or I don't think the anti-war movement was blaming Saudi Arabia for, you know, dragging the U.S. into war in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's very new, and it's become sort of this, you know, mainstream narrative that Saudi Arabia or Israel or mostly Saudi Arabia is responsible for dragging the U.S. into war. And I think it's problematic because it allows the U.S. to shift blame every time it's forced to answer for its failures in foreign policy or failures or, you know, purposeful failures. It's very, very, very troubling. I don't want to see the U.S. absolved. So that's why I've been, you know, hammering on it.
I'm even critical of the sort of paleocon mentality about Israel and specifically AIPAC. Like, I think there's good criticism to be made of AIPAC, but, you know, a lot of the paleoconservative commentary on AIPAC basically amounts to the whole Zionist occupied government conspiracy theories of militia movements. And I think that directs a lot of attention away from
U.S. imperialism.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Thank you, Samira.
Yeah, that's...
Robbie, maybe you could comment, though, because I think you have a really strong opinion about this sort of, I guess, the narrative of the tail wagging the dog that people push with regards to either Saudi Arabia or Israel, sort of, you know, telling the U.S. what to do and having complete control over our foreign policy.
Yeah, well, I wanted to touch on something Samira said earlier, where there is this sort of acceptance now, even on the left, to sort of, you know, place a lot of blame on Saudi Arabia specifically and sort of accuse them of being this, you know, almost like they're puppeting us type of dynamic. You know, they have so much power over us. And while there is an element of truth to the idea that they have power, a lot of investments with us, I mean, I think what's fueling a lot of that also is this sort of idea, which I would describe as sort of a limited hangout narrative that's become widely accepted on the left and even in the mainstream realm now, in the past few years, that Saudi Arabia is who was responsible for 9/11. And that's sort of become, you know, a generally accepted thing. And somehow, you know, Saudi Arabia did this. And I think that that kind of fuels some of that. It's like, you know, so I think that that has a role in it. But as I'll always say, you know, if you blame Saudi Arabia for 9/11, you point a finger at them, that points like three fingers back at us. There's no way that you can blame Saudi Arabia for the attacks and not also blame the United States. I mean, the Bush administration was so deeply in bed, you know, with the Saudi government in so many ways that just that alone should make you question that at face value. I mean, Bandar Bush, look right. him up if you don't know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, no, it's strange. And, yeah, I do have a very strong opinion on this gravitational force, again, of this idea that that the U.S. is this poor little soul of a country. It's just, you know, sort of pushed and pulled by these different foreign entities to try to drag it into war. I mean, what happened to the paradigm here that when the first Gulf War happened, it was widely known that ExxonMobil, BP, you know, all these mainly American oil companies were driving that conflict. And now it's like it's all about Saudi Arabia. And what happened to American oil interests? I mean, clearly the Trump administration is filled with, you know, American oil executives. And why aren't people making that connection? I mean, like, what happened to that basic connection? Now it just becomes this sort of game about, you know, which foreign government is doing what and how they're, you know, trying to mess with us. And I just think it really is sort of a reductive narrative. And I would rather people go back to maybe the older school paradigm of seeing all these, you know, a lot of these military operations and even just our intelligence operations as ways to help corporate America. And not just corporate America, but like international corporations and sort of the ruling class at large. I mean, it goes back to Smedley Butler.
Yeah, even liberals are latching onto this to paint Trump as some sort of agent of a foreign power. Chris Hayes alluded to the Saudi Arabia thing the other day. And when Chris Hayes is saying it, something's up.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I didn't even realize he was saying stuff like that. Yeah, so I think, again, it just definitely takes agency away from the power of the ruling class, the corporations, and the U.S. hegemonic forces. You know, these powerful entities in D.C. and all around the country that have been wanting to increase empire. And just like, you know, one example of that is Bolton leaving isn't going to solve the problem of these gigantic forces trying to drive us into war with Iran. They will still try to do this with or without John Bolton being in the Trump administration. And I just feel like people are just oversimplifying what's happening. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what that is. And I'm largely blaming a lot of alternative media outlets that I see pushing these narratives.
I think it's for public consumption, but I think that that minimizes the danger of U.S. imperialism. You know, that's the biggest problem with it.
Yeah, I agree.
And it doesn't acknowledge the reasons behind it. You know, I think, yeah, the old paradigm used to be very simple, no blood for oil. Now it's, well, we can't be bossed around by the Saudi kings.
It's exception. It's like another form of American exceptionalism too, right? A little bit.
And I think the main point too is that it obscures just what Robbie was saying, the reasons for these wars. And Bolton, too, that was a personal dispute. It was nothing more than that. There was no ideological content to John Bolton being fired, really. because the forces that are powering U.S. imperialism are much larger. And when I say forces, you know, I mean economic forces. And this empire in decline, there's people, they're trying to get grab the last pie while the going's good, right? And yeah, a lot of mainstream or semi-mainstream analysis ignores that and reduces it to this court intrigue.
Well, yeah. The other aspect of that, and Marlon, I sort of wanted to get your take on this before we close out, is you know, on one hand we have the declining empire and you know the neocons and centrist liberals, the neoliberals sort of, you know, wanting to make one last power grab and sort of going crazy about Venezuela, China, Syria, all these places. And on the other, I sort of alluded to it earlier, there's a whole segment of the left now that just argues that any talk of anti-interventionism is, you know, you're an agent for Russia, you're part of the fascist plot, the fascist international. And I'm sure Mike Gravel has even been accused of that. I know everyone here has at one point or another, I don't know if you have, Marlon, but everyone here has been accused of being, you know, Russian agents. You know, Robbie with Abby and RT, and also Samira has worked for RT. So you've gotten those accusations. Marlon, what do you make of this segment of the left that sort of has gone against anti-imperialist sentiments?
I think, yeah, part of it comes down to branding. There's been this brand of anti-war that is comfortable with the right. And so some people in good faith look at it and they go, oh, well, yeah, so this anti-intervention appellation was invented almost to take anti-war and slime it. And it's actually not that new, you know? They used to always say this about people who were pacifists or, you know, against where they say they were pro-Soviet and this and that. Some of them probably were pro-Soviet, but they didn't go any further than talking about that. And so a lot of people associated with that are like, they call themselves the anti-authoritarian left. They say, you know, I don't know, they want to be pure as the driven snow, unfortunately, and not engage in reality of world politics, I guess. You can't support anyone. You can't do that. You know, you can't have any opinion because there are flaws. Like, oh, you're against war with Iran? You must support the clerics, right? I think it's not that complicated, and it's very old.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's even, you know, there's really good textbook examples of that from, like, World War II. Like, it's, you get this impression now that the only people who protested World War II who were Americans were, like, pro-Hitler. Or like American fascists, or like the associated with like Lindbergh or those kinds of people. As not the case at all. There are plenty of actual pacifists who actually did protest American involvement in World War II. Like, so that those people just get written out of history, you know, in favor of this smeary association. It's kind of like saying that, you know, hands off Syria means you're a fascist like Richard Spencer and Mike Cernovich or something.
Yeah.
It's like, no. I mean, what? Like, not wanting to bomb or invade another country as fascist? Like, what the hell? I mean, it literally is the most upside down, you know, propagandistic rhetoric ever, really. I mean,
it's quite literally liberal interventionism.
Right. And I would say the only reason why people like Cernovich or Spencer say they're against these wars is because it's branding. They think it looks good to be against war, you know?
And they don't want, quote unquote, foreigners coming into the country and destroying America. That's
it'll promote, reasoning. Yeah, it'll promote refugees. It'll make tons of refugees, and we can't have that. That's their outlook.
Well, closing out here, I wanted to ask Samira real quickly, where do you think things are going with the geopolitical grand chessboard, just sort of from your perspective of foreign policy analysis?
I think that Kashmir needs to be looked at closely because, like I said, three nuclear powers, and you guys mentioned Saudi Arabia and Iran. the world doesn't look too good these days. Let's just say that.
Well, you know, something I just thought of that I mentioned before, and I don't think I got your takes on it, was, you know, I said earlier that I think a lot of issues that we're talking about are interconnected. You know, like, people worry about climate change. I think if you're worried about climate change, you have to be worried about American militarism, because I think that contributes to environmental problems. Or, you know, if you're worried about Medicare for All not happening, you know, that could more easily happen if we had less of our money going to the defense budget. Maybe we could have Robbie and Marlin comment on the way that the issue of being against the Empire, going up against the Empire, is connected to issues at home, in the way that Martin Luther King sort of tied together economic injustice, racism, and you know, the Vietnam War. Robbie, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways to do it just like he did it today, but barely anyone who has a large platform is doing that, and it's a real shame. And instead, what we get is sort of this reductive, nationalistic MAGA version of it, where it's like, we need to stop, you know, spending money on these other countries and just, like, make America great again. And that's the version of that we get right now. And it's just so, yeah, I mean, it really is just a really self-centered view. And I'm not saying that that means we should intervene in other countries. I'm just saying that it's not linking all these other things together.
Well, can I add something really quick to that? I think it's interesting with this whole MAGA thing, because, you know, everyone is willing to talk about the militarism abroad. I think average folks are. I know a lot of everyday folks that are very against the wars, but what we're seeing now is that militarism abroad is coming home. I mean, we're witnessing the militarization of our police, what we see with the ICE camps. I mean, it's coming home now. The militarism abroad is now becoming domestic. We're seeing a militarization of America.
Well, the Empire feeds on the Republic, right? You know, there's this argument from a lot of the right wing anti-interventionists. Well, oh, it doesn't. We actually lose money. You know, why are we doing this? We're losing money. But the people whose interest it serves are not losing money, and it's taxpayers mostly who pay for the wars, and they get nothing back for it. Putting the morality aside, like, you shouldn't be a murderer.
Gas prices going up during the Iraq war didn't hurt the ruling classes that were benefiting and profiting off of the war. I mean, it hurts the regular dude who's trying to get to work in the morning.
Exactly.
Just to pay fucking $4 a gallon because we're in the Middle East bombing shit all the time.
Right. So there was a moral component, but then there's also that basic, you know, pragmatic appeal you could make that it hurts you. It hurts others a lot more. They should be clear about it. You should be clear about that. But you're not going to get anything good from it either. Not at this point.
But people would rather say that Saudi Arabia and Israel are dragging the U.S. into war.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, I always like to say that I like to end each show on a positive note. I don't know if they're in these dark times that there's a positive note, but I want to give each of you a chance to give some final thoughts, positive or negative. Let's start with Samira.
Oh, gosh. Yeah,
I'm putting you on the hot seat.
Yeah, I'm a pessimist because I feel like as a political scientist, you have to put it simply, prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. Yeah, that's all.
Robbie, you want to go next?
Yeah, I mean, I am a pessimist as well. I think right now, I think there's a little bit, well, not a little bit, there's way too much faith-based thinking, and there's sort of this weird reductivist viewpoint that's taking over everything in these sectors of discussion, which used to be more nuanced and intelligently had between people. And I think we need to bring it back to that. And also not just that, but like the moral angle, the moral framework to this, which often gets lost in this dominant sort of MAGA, you know, nationalistic framework. So I think those are very basic things. And
I don't think it's that hard to reach people on those. I just think that this other dominant paradigm is being boosted. You know, even like people like Robert Mercer and some of these other billionaires are boosting that narrative. So we need to see that, I think, as a toxifying narrative that should be combated, and not because we want to argue with people online, but just to try to get people to a more, you know, ultimately a stronger anti-war position, even if you're just looking at it strategically, because I think the moral framework of it does make it stronger. It can't just be from a self-centered point of view. So, yeah, I guess that's what the last thing I'll say on that.
And Marlon, I know that we've got a hat trick of pessimism here. Maybe there's not much hope for the anti-imperialist movement in the U.S. Because I know, Marlon, you're going to have a pessimistic view as well.
Well, yeah, I'll sort of rephrase Samira's thing a little more Gramscian. You know, optimism, pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will is my position, but I struggle with the optimism of the will. I think but I'll try to say something positive because I'm the last one speaking.
That was the only reason I said it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, I'm basically a pessimist through and through.
I will say though, I think the way out of it is very simple, but it's hard to do. You know, politics is, you know, testing what communities can do. That's what politics is. And I know personally, I've had trouble doing politics late the past couple of years because I've been moving around a lot. So I haven't felt like I've been able to get involved politically so much because I'm in one place shortly and in another place. But I think people, you know, politics really comes less from watching personalities on television and discussing with them. That you're not often convinced by that. You're more often convinced by conversations you have with people you know. So if you are in one place and planning to be there for a while, just talk to people you know, and more people will agree with you than you think. And hopefully that can be the basis for something. I hope I'm not being too mawkish by saying that.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I want to thank Samira Khan, Robbie Martin, and Marlon Ettinger again for participating in this roundtable discussion. I think this is the most guests I've had on one show, so that's an accomplishment for me a little bit. And I want to thank you all for participating in it. And if there's anything you guys want to plug, websites people should check out, let's do that right now. Samira, any work that you need to promote?
You can follow me on Twitter, Samira Khan, SamEraKhan, and then I post my work there.
Robbie?
Yeah, same. I mean, Twitter is probably where I keep post the most recent stuff. You can follow me at Fluorescent Gray, and you could also check out my film series at veryheavyagenda.com.
And you're doing live streams now, too, so people should check those out as well.
Yeah, I just did a pretty long one on the 9/11 anniversary. Yeah, I'm trying to do them more regularly, but for now they're a little bit sporadic. But I announced them on Twitter, so that's where you'll find out about them.
And Marlon, anything you have in the works?
You can follow me on Twitter too, Marlon Ettinger, MarlonEttinger. I do have some podcasts coming out soon. It's not as serious, but there's some serious episodes. We talk with some interesting people, academics mostly.
Well, thank you guys again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you, man.
Well, that does it for this special roundtable edition of Parallax Views. What did you think about the opinions of our guests, foreign policy analyst Samira Khan, Media Roots Robbie Martin, and freelance journalist Marlon Ettinger? Why don't you drop me a line at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com or hop on Twitter @viewsparallax. I would love to get your feedback. I want to thank Samira Khan, Robbie Martin, and Marlon Ettinger for participating in this roundtable conversation, and I hope that you found it extremely fruitful and enlightening. Some news for Parallax Views Patreon supporters. I have a new series entitled The Week That Was, co-piloted by my pal Casey, where the two of us go over current events that end up falling down the memory hole. In this age where every news story has 15 minutes, or is that 15 seconds of fame before said stories are lost to time. So if you're a fan of Parallax Views and you're interested in listening to that, head over to the Parallax Views Patreon page. Your support is what keeps this show alive. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.